I'm Christopher Lydon, listening for the rest of the story of the new India with Arundhati Roy, the writer, the conscience, sometimes the scourge of her country in its capitalist development boom. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one, with the Indian firebrand who is read and heard all over the world, Arundhati Roy, first an architect, then the Booker Prize novelist of The God of Small Things, now the essayist on democracy in its gravest danger, and the reporter on the violent insurgency burning in the core of India's famous 21st century expansion. Arundhati, we hear a lot about Bangalore and the billionaires, but for you, we'd hear almost nothing about the burning forests of Dantewada. That was an extraordinary account of the insurgency, the comrades, Maoism in the middle of India. Can you take us there?
Yeah, well, I've been there in those forests with the guerrillas. Something in me flinches when they're called insurgents because this is their forest. You know, they've lived there for generations. They are the indigenous people. A lot of them have become Maoists now. There's something about that word insurgents that suggests that they are, rebelling against a local authority, whereas actually what is happening is that this whole area is a forested mineral belt. If you look at a map of India, the forests, the minerals, the indigenous people, and now the Maoist movement are all stacked up on top of each other. The minerals in that area have been bauxite and iron ore and coal and all of that has been valued in not billions but trillions of dollars. And now, because of the new economic regime, all of that has been handed over to private companies, and the governments have signed what we call MOUs, which are memorandums of understanding worth billions of dollars. The way it works, of course, is that the private company, let's say in iron ore, the private company makes $100, the Indian government makes 60 cents. This is the proportion of how profits are divided. So they have signed these billions of dollars of MOUs and now suddenly come upon a massive and entrenched resistance there. So the government has declared what it calls Operation Green Hunt, where you have something like 70,000 paramilitary forces closing in on the forests and the homelands of indigenous people. Yes, a lot of them are Maoists. In fact, almost all the Maoists are indigenous people.
What does that mean today, Maoist, in India?
It's hard to say what it means. It means different things to different people. For the government, every kind of resistance from Gandhian to the armed Maoist uprising, everyone is being called a Maoist. I mean, people like me are being called Maoist sympathizers. The People's Union of Civil Liberties and the People's Union of Democratic Rights are being called Maoist overground operations. There are laws in place that criminalize even thinking an anti-government thought. You know, laws like the Chhattisgarh Special Public Security Act. But, of course, there are people who genuinely call themselves Maoist who have been in those forests for almost 30 years. In fact, in the state of Chhattisgarh, which is at the heart of India, there's a river called Indravati, which the police call the border. And across the river is area that has been traditionally controlled by the Maoists, which is called Pakistan. And the police say that they have permission to shoot on sight in that area, in Pakistan, in what they call Pakistan. And there is a seriously entrenched opposition to these mining corporations. Of course, it precedes the MOUs and the mining, but we keep saying that what the government calls the Maoist corridor could equally be called the MOUist corridor. And the fact is that I think everything turns on the definition of how are you going to define a Maoist. The superintendent of police who I once met showed me pictures of 18 young villagers who had been killed. He says, "See, ma'am, these are Maoists. My boys killed them." I said, I can see that they've been killed, but I don't know how I'm supposed to tell that they're Maoists. So he said, "Oh, look, they have malaria medicines and Dettol bottles and all these things from outside." Because this is an area which has no schools, no hospitals, no nothing since independence, since 1947. I was so shocked to find that it isn't just about war and fighting and guerrilla armies, but there's been development in their own small ways, water harvesting, check dams, an attempt to sort of be self-sufficient. There is, I think, 50% or 45% of the guerrilla armed cadre are women. And so far, between Chhattisgarh, Jharkhand, Orissa, and West Bengal, they have actually managed to hold off these huge mining corporations. It's a very interesting story, of course, how the Maoists came to be called the greatest internal security threat.
Well, I was just going to say, Manmohan Singh, who was President Obama's guest at the White House just before Christmas, calls this guerrilla movement the gravest internal security threat to India. In your own remarkable, long, almost book-length report in Outlook India, you say, there in the forests of Dantewada, a battle rages for the soul of India. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that I hope I don't give you a long book-like answer, but
you please go ahead.
But basically, let me start in 1989, when capitalism won its jihad against Soviet communism in the bleak mountains of Afghanistan. And at that time, India thought of itself as a non-aligned country in the Cold War. But the minute the Soviet Union collapsed, India realigned itself and became, what you would call a comprador nation, completely aligned with the United States. And it didn't need any military intervention to fall in line. The way I look at it is that the government opened two locks. One was a lock of an old 16th century mosque called the Babri Masjid, which was a disputed site sealed by the courts. It was a mosque which the Hindus claimed was the birthplace of Ram. And opening the lock of the Babri Masjid, which the Congress government did, unleashed one kind of fundamentalism, which was Hindu right-wing extremism. At the same time, it opened another metaphorical lock, which is a lock on the Indian market, which had been regulated and protected till then, and opened it up to international finance, to the free market. And both these unleashed two kinds of fundamentalism into India, Hindu fundamentalism and market fundamentalism. Both of them, 20 years down the line, have sort of manufactured their own kinds of terrorism. On the one hand, Islamist terrorism, and on the other hand, this Maoist insurgency. Because the new regime of economic policies, they dismantled workers' protection and workers' rights. They allowed for the privatization of infrastructure, water, electricity, telecom, housing, education. As a result of which, things that had already been happening, of course, displacement and so on, but suddenly the burners were turned to high, and it's resulted in the kind of dispossession that I don't think anybody is keeping track of,
And can I just say with a little embarrassment that I sort of missed that story when it happened? We were all aware of Deng Xiaoping and the capitalist new road for China. But the idea that India, Gandhi's country, Nehru's country, the nation of sadhus and wise men and and Tagore and all that stuff was taking a fundamentally different road, I was asleep, I think. Were you aware right away, were Indians given a chance, in a sense, to vote, to choose, to see where they were going?
Well, Indians, I have to say some Indians were off the mark right from the start. You know, they realized exactly what was going on and what the results of this would be. Because it wasn't as though either of these two fundamentalisms that I speak of, it wasn't as though they didn't exist subcutaneously earlier. It's just that they were then privileged, you know, and became the scourge of the nation as it is today. But yes, it radically altered not just the material conditions, but, you know, with the nuclear tests, for example, in 98, as soon as this right-wing Hindu BJP government came to power, it just changed the language, the spirit, the political discourse, this sort of ugly nationalism, which I think today anybody who visits India and looks at the media and the TV channels is disgusted by, you know, the kind of rabid nationalism that is pushed down your throats all the time. I think the most moderate channels are Fox News and the most extreme are Fox on Coke, you know, but that's how it is right now. These media channels, of course, owned by various corporations who have stakes in this process. And so millions of people have just been erased from the story. It's as if they just do not exist. You know, sometimes they appear as characters on sort of NGO pamphlets, but beyond that, that story has just been wiped off the pages. And I actually have spoken to foreign correspondents from major newspapers who've told me that they have instructions, no negative stories from India, because India is the finance destination for all this corporate capital. So it must be a good investment destination, you know. So if you have, the fact is in 2002, we had the massacre of 2,000 Muslims brazenly, openly on the streets of Gujarat. We had women gang raped and killed and burnt alive. You had 150,000 Muslims driven from their homes. And of course it was reported, but it was quickly covered up. Because India's a great finance destination. So,
of course, the story is eclipsed by the news of Bangalore, the information technology revolution, the coordination with Silicon Valley so that the computers never sleep. What room do you make for the boom and for the good news of growth and middle-class wealth in the new India?
You see, the thing is that Nothing in history, and I speak of, you know, everything from Nazi Germany down, obviously nothing can be only bad news, you know. But if you were to say, but didn't Hitler build roads, everybody would jump down your throat, right? What did the boom do? It created, a huge middle class, because India is such a huge country, even a small percentage is a huge number of people. It created a huge middle class, which is completely invested in this process. So it did lift a large number of people into a different economic bracket altogether. Of course, India has, I think, now more billionaires than China and so on. But it created a far larger underclass that's being pushed into oblivion. We have, India is home to the largest number of malnutrition children in the world. You have 180,000 small farmers who've drunk pesticide and committed suicide because they, they've been caught in the debt trap. You have a kind of ecocide where, huge infrastructural projects have been doing a kind of environmental engineering that's causing a drop in the water table, that's not a single river now flows to the sea. There's a disaster there in the making. And, you know, the way I see it is you had a very We had a feudal society decaying under the weight of its caste system and so on, was put into a machine and churned. And some of the old sort of discriminations were recalibrated. But what happened was that the whole thing sort of separated into a layer of thick cream, a thin layer of thick cream, and the rest of it is water. And the cream is India's market, which consists of many millions of people who buy cell phones and TVs and cars and Valentine's Day cards and so on. And the water is just superfluous people who are non-consumers and who are just stored in holding ponds, and you know, they just need to be drained away. And those people are now rising up, and those people are the ones that are fighting the system in a whole lot of different ways. You know, there's what I call a biodiversity of resistance. There are Gandhians on the roads and Maoists in the forest, but all of them have the same idea, that this development model is only working for some and not for others. So when you say, for me, when people say, but why do you keep talking about the negative part of what's going on? I think, firstly, I don't think very many people ask that question when people are only talking about the positive part, you know. But the way I see it is, if you're 10 people in a room and something's going on, and two people are millionaires, and two people, you know, have just made it through, you know, to the top, one person is just managing to survive, and five people are starving, you look at that mathematically and you say, okay, it's 50-50 or 30-60 or something. When you look at that politically, are you going to place yourself there with those two people who are doing well, or are you going to place yourself with the five people who are not managing to survive? That's your politics, you know? So I'm not prepared to look at it and say, oh, these two guys are doing really well, so things must be okay. You know, I'm going to put myself, even if it was one person who was who was not managing to survive, I would put myself there. But in this case, it's not one person. It's the majority of the population.
Take us back to that Dantewada forest. Such an extraordinary diversity of people. A lot of them women, as you say. They're young people. Happiness is taken seriously. They dance. There's a culture. There's a great deal of tradition. A lot of them are farmers. A lot of them come from elsewhere. What are they drawing on? Sketch the vision that unites those people.
Well, actually, they are all local people, except for a few people who have come from, you know, Andhra Pradesh, which is also more or less local. They just crossed the border.
But there are people from headquarters and there are people from the village. And
yeah, but most of them, I mean, 99.9% of them are local tribal people. And they, and what has happened is that since 1967, which was when the first sort of Maoist uprising took place in West Bengal, the Maoist movement has always been strongest among tribal people, partly because of the, I think because the government has hunted them down and exterminated. Actually, that word is true. They've exterminated Maoists of outside of the forest, so the forest provides cover. But also because of several other reasons. The tribal people in these areas have a history of resistance which predates Mao by centuries, you know. And they have resisted and risen up against the British several times. The fact that they still exist as tribes is proof of their resilience in some way. But what happened in after Indian independence, when India adopted its constitution, it just took over British policy on tribal lands, and it made the entire sort of tribal homeland the property of the Indian state, and in overnight turned those people into squatters on their own lands, criminalized their way of life. You know, the forests were now under the Forest Department. Everything the tribal did was illegal or anti-constitutional. So in a way, just like the Maoists, theoretically, they've been outside of the system. And now the two have, they found each other in some way. And it's hard to tell how Maoist the Maoists are and how tribal the tribal people are. But together, it's an insurrection now. And as I said, an insurrection against, right now, against this corporate push. But I think that what's interesting about what's going on there is that in this era of an understanding of climate change and so on, here is a people and here is an ecology that is really a world heritage. And here are people who perhaps, though we think of them as relics of our past, may well be the keepers of the secrets of the future. You know, they are people who know to live in sustainably in that place. They don't want the bauxite out of the mountain. Mm. They want it inside the mountain. They don't want the iron ore outside the forest. They don't want the wood off the trees. You know, they don't have any use necessarily for all of that. Though even, of course, that culture is also under influence and under attack. It's not that they are some pristine people. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying they have the imagination for a different kind of world, for a different understanding of what happiness is, what fulfillment is. And I don't believe, since we all know that this is a planet rushing towards cataclysm, I don't believe that the imagination for change is going to come from the imagination that's created the cataclysm. It's going to come from people who have a different imagination outside of capitalism, outside of even communism. And the first step is not to annihilate those people. The first step is to keep that alive, because keeping that alive keeps hope alive. And to do that, we have to leave the bauxite in the mountain. We have to leave the water in the river. We have to leave the trees in the forest.
What is the commitment of the tribal people to an armed struggle here? And what is your own wisdom on the future of an armed struggle? It sounds uneven, and we can sort of imagine how a straight test of military power is going to end. How committed are they to guns to save them?
Looking at the various struggles in India, I think you have to look at the geography and the ecology and the environment in which various struggles take various shapes. So we tend to look at it ideologically, but I actually look at it differently, in the sense that outside the forest are people who are in some ways, even the Dalit population, which is probably the most humiliated population in India. It's outside the forest. It's partly inside society. And so these movements, perhaps strategically, can be Gandhian, because they, not that the Dalit movement will be Gandhian, because many radical Dalits despise Gandhi, you know, which I'm sure is hard for a Western audience to understand. But anyway, that's a separate, separate subject. But inside the forest, when I was walking with them, and when I saw the assault, which usually takes the form of, say, 300, 400, 1,000 policemen walking through the forest and cordoning off a village at dawn, you know, picking up villagers, using them as human shields, walking into the village, burning it down and all of that. And I began to wonder, I said, how do people who are already starving go on a hunger strike? How do people who have no money refuse to pay their taxes or boycott foreign goods? You know, Gandhian nonviolent resistance needs an audience, a sort of sympathetic audience, an audience which can somehow be forced to view you with sympathy eventually and cave in. But these are people who've already been erased from the public imagination. They are outside of society. They do not have an audience. And in the darkness of a village night, when you're surrounded by 1,000 policemen who are going to burn your village, you don't have that many options. Outside of the forest, if you were to pick up a gun, you would be eliminated straight away. And the real danger now is that eventually, if the government isn't forced to back off from Operation Green Hunt, they are talking about helicopter gunships, about brigade headquarters, about drones. These are the weapons they are going to use against the poor, against the indigenous people, you know. And already they had started this process of what is known as strategic hamletting, which you in the U.S. must be familiar with. Used in Vietnam, and the Indian Army has used it several times. And they tried to force people to move from their villages into roadside camps, and said that those who did not move would all be called Maoists and therefore were liable to be, quote-unquote, wiped out. Mm. So in a moment, first of all, the Constitution makes them unconstitutional, and then this announcement turns people who are just looking after their chickens or cultivating their fields into terrorists, you know. So ultimately, to define poverty as a crime is what has happened. Mm.
What would Gandhi say? This comes up in so many conversations about the new India. Where is Gandhi? Where is the nation of villages? Where is the peace tradition? What would Gandhi be telling the tribes today?
Well, I'm afraid I'm not a big fan of Gandhi, you know, because he did say some very wise things about sustainable living and so on. But he also said he had this theory of trusteeship, you know, and he said everybody must remain nonviolent. The rich man must be allowed to keep his wealth and to use it in whatever way he thinks fit, and whatever is surplus he should try and use for the poor.
He is even taken by some people these days as a friend of small capitalism, even big capitalism.
I used to say he's India's first NGO, because he was supported by the Birlas and the Tatas. You know, they used to say it takes a lot of money to keep the old man in poverty was one of the things that was said. But I'm not saying that there wasn't things of great value in what he said. But when you look at this kind of thing, you know, he was a status quoist, whether it was about capitalism or whether it was about caste. He was a status quoist. And that's all right, you know, when you belong to the comfortable classes. It's not all right when you're a Dalit or when you're a tribal facing a police attack. Hmm.
What did you make of that wonderful moment in a classroom in the South last fall, opening of school, and a little girl asked President Obama if he could have dinner with anybody in the world, living, dead, real or imagined, who would it be? And he took rather a long pause and said, "I think Gandhi." What did that mean to you?
Well, I think you have to try and understand why Gandhi's become such a stuffed toy for everybody, you know, cuddly, warm, cuddly man who doesn't threaten anything and doesn't threaten anyone.
Ooh, I don't know about that.
Yeah, for me, this is very becoming...
Didn't threaten the Brits, the war machine, or the standard way of settling disputes? Didn't threaten Churchill?
No, I'm saying now, not... Then I'm saying now, what does Gandhianism mean? You know, it's true that at the time when the freedom struggle happened, there is a lot of false publicity around the fact that it was only Gandhi who single-handedly did it. This was not the case. you know.
Of course.
And there was a whole diffusion, you know, very, very problematic stuff that was going on in India at the time, and Gandhi and Nehru de-radicalized. I mean, they used a lot of peasant movements and then sort of de-radicalized them at the last minute. Why? What happened? I mean, after India became independent, the brown sahabs just stepped into the shoes of the white sahabs, you know. Nothing was changed. Even the laws, the judiciary, the administrative service, it was not a revolution. You know, sure, the British left and that was good, but it was in no way a transformative experience for many, many Indian people. The middle class, yes.
And whose fault was that?
It was like a negotiation, you know, and I think the British also, because of the war, had to leave. You know, they were overstretched and all of that. But, and again, I'm not saying it was a bad thing, it was a good thing. But if you look at, if you read a lot of, say, radical Dalit literature, you will find that the Dalits were, for example, very frightened of being now ruled by a Hindu upper caste. You know, at least the British didn't think of them as untouchables. But here now you had a upper caste nation. And the other thing, I mean, it's a slight digression, but I'd like to say is that the day India became a sovereign nation, it turned into a colonial power. It began to make war, to annex states. It made war in Nagaland, Manipur, Kashmir, Hyderabad, Telangana, Goa. And then, of course, the military interventions continued. And when you look at them, I was shocked. You know, I was thinking about it only recently, and I started thinking, tribals, Christians, Sikhs, Muslims, communists, and you suddenly see this upper caste Hindu state making these military interventions, killing people with complete impunity. You know, it was a very frightening process that happened. But coming back to what you were asking about Gandhi, so I think
and Obama,
Gandhi as Gandhi in the independence struggle is one thing, and Gandhi into what he has been made, you know, the icon of Gandhi and the comforting nature of his iconization is a separate thing. And to me, there's nothing more violent than a man who says that the rich men should keep their money and use it in whatever way they like to help the poor. You know, that is to support a kind of structural violence, which is very, very serious. It's a very, very serious thing to say.
What did it tell you about Barack Obama?
Well, Barack Obama, I wanted to be happy when he won the elections, because I wanted to feel that I could be happy more than, and I felt very moved when I saw people who had lived through the civil rights struggles, the tears in their eyes when they saw, you know, a black man becoming the president of this country. And I don't think we should take away from the symbolic value of that. But then when I saw him giving that Nobel Peace Prize speech justifying war, and the tears of those old black ladies cut and paste into the eyes of powerful white people at that ceremony, hearing him say what they wanted him to hear, it was so terrible, you know. And what is going on in Afghanistan, that expansion of that war, the absolute cluelessness of the American government. They cannot understand base one of what they are doing there. The war spilling into Pakistan, into Kashmir, into the rest of India. It's unforgivable, you know, that you're just perpetuating a situation, creating mayhem in a region. And I don't think anyone has any clue. I mean, beginning with the word Taliban, what does it mean? You're going to wipe out the Taliban. Taliban is an ideology. you created it in the first place. It's not a fixed number of people. It's not an army. Nobody has a tattoo on them saying Taliban, that you can kill them. You know, you're just creating more and more of that. And it's a war being fought by one side that is completely incomprehending of the other side. And the thing is that you can surely go and bomb Iraq and bomb Afghanistan and bomb Pakistan, but you can't administer those places. You know, to administer those places, you need boots on the ground. Mm. And those boots have no idea what they're doing. People who are from there can hardly govern those places. They are so complex. They are far more complex than Western countries, you know, which have been computerized, numbered and barcoded, you know. Those people, we people, can barely govern ourselves. I mean, someone is welcome to try and govern India. So you can bomb a place, but you cannot win the war.
How do we Americans listen for a true Indian identity in this period of fantastic growth and, as you say, fantastic suffering?
You know, I have stopped being able to think of things like American and Indian and Chinese and African. I don't know what those words mean anymore. Hmm. Because in America, as in India, as in China, what has happened is that the elites of these countries and the corporations that support their wealth and generate it for them have seceded into outer space. They live somewhere in the sky and they are their own country, you know. And they look down at the bauxite in Orissa and the, you know, and the iron ore in Chhattisgarh, and they say, what's our bauxite doing in their mountains? And what's our iron ore doing in their forests? And they then justify to themselves the reasons for this war. If you look at what is going on now in that part of the world, from Afghanistan to the northeast frontiers of Pakistan to Waziristan to the northeastern states of India to this so-called Red Corridor in India, what you're seeing is a tribal uprising. And it's taking the form of radical Islam in Afghanistan. It's taking the form of radical communism in India. It's taking the form of struggles for self-determination in the northeastern states. But it's a tribal uprising, and the assault on them is coming from the same place. It's coming from the free market, from capitalism's desire to capture and control what it thinks of as resources. I think resources is a problematic word because, you know, they cannot be replenished, these things, once they are looted. But that is really the thing. And the people who are being able to fight are those who are outside of the barcoded, cell phone networked, you know, electronic age, who cannot be tracked and who can barely be understood. It's a clash of civilizations, but not in the way that Huntington meant, you know. It's an inability to understand, you know, that the world has to change, or there will be, I mean, as we know, I mean, capitalism contains within itself the idea of a protracted war. But in that war, either you learn to keep the bauxite in the mountain, or you're not going to benefit from preaching morality to the victims, you know, of this war. A victory for this sort of establishment and its army and its nuclear weapons will never be a victory, because your victory is your defeat, you know.
I guess I'm still wondering just about the mind, the spirit, the soul of India in its own terms. I mean, we tend to see too much TED Talk India, maybe too much Nandan Nilekani India, certainly too much Tom Friedman India, this incessant celebration of the Bangalore transformation. Where do we look for the rest of India's spirit?
The really wonderful thing about India is that outside of all the things you mentioned, there's a very fierce spirit of resistance. There is an alternative way of looking that actually exists. It's been annihilated in America, in Europe. There isn't a real sort of society that actually lives outside of that sort of nanny state that takes care of everybody, and everybody's listed, everybody has a number and a name. And now Nanda Nilekani wants to give everybody a number in India, but actually now, till now, everybody doesn't have a number. And there is a wilderness in the imagination that is still there, and that is fighting back. The superfluous people left out of this capitalist imagination are fighting back. And because it's a country with such huge numbers, and because it has paraded itself as a democracy and therefore has to adhere to certain rituals, it's having a problem. The upper classes sometimes quite openly say, look, all these countries that have progressed have a past. They have all eliminated huge populations. Why can't we? I have heard people say that, you know. I mean, the really frightening thing, of course, is that the people in the jungle who I was with, they are people on the edge of survival. You know, they are living they're living in conditions of near starvation. They have been put under siege. They are not being allowed to go out into the markets to buy stuff, you know, with whatever little money they get from their fields and so on. It's a situation which is, in a way, not by openly killing people, but in other ways, by cutting them off from their resources, from medical help, from every other kind of thing, that is trying to get rid of these people. So it's important for those of us who are outside to stand up and to take sides. But as I said, there is a whole imagination in India which is outside this acceptable notion of what is development. I mean, how do they even calculate development? By calculating how much sugar you consume, or how much electricity you consume, or how much you consume, which is really such a sad way of calculating progress or development, you know. And there is a different way. There's a different way. And, of course, I mean, numerically, we even know that though India's got the highest number of millionaires, in its development index, it's below Guinea and Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan and so on, because there are populations living with the food grain intake less than sub-Saharan Africa,
I dream of getting to India before this year is out. I dream of you guiding me, but above all, maybe I would love you to walk Tom Friedman around your India. Can it be done? Could you introduce plain people like me to that eternally resistant alternative mind of India?
Well, I could certainly introduce you. I don't think I could introduce Tom Friedman, because I don't think that these people are looking at that. They don't want to see it, you know, because that sort of messes with their theories. It messes with the framework that they have built for themselves, you know. So he can say, look at the Muslims in India, they're so wonderful, you know, they work in call centers or whatever it is. You don't want to see the massacre in Gujarat. You don't want to know that 70,000 people were killed in Kashmir. You don't want to know how many hundreds of young Muslims are being held without bail under terrorism laws. You don't want to know about the fake encounters. You don't want to know about the ghettoization in Gujarat. Muslims are ghettoized, and the colonies they live in are also called Pakistan. So everywhere that there's a ghetto, it's Pakistan. India is slowly turning into Pakistan in some ways. And but you want to wipe all this out, you know, and you want to shine the light on where the light is already shining. And surely it is shining on Bangalore and on you know, the Forbes list of billionaires and all of that.
And large portions of Bombay. What do you make of the migration to Bombay and the lure that many good people feel, I don't think they're all driven to it, of leaving the $2 a day village life for a piece of this chaotic but rising economy?
Nobody has any idea of how people live in Bombay. They don't go there because they are, they are driven there. I mean, I've seen hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people in Bombay live in the most, you can't in your nightmare imagine how they live there. You know, and the whole debate.
I know mainly Suketu Mehta's account. I haven't been to Bombay for 30 years.
Yeah, but it's. I've just been there recently. You know, I was there with the mill workers whose mills have all been shut down, and you know they are of course the older residents of Bombay. But the thing is that legally, what is happening is that you have a Supreme Court which is so kind of tied in to the market. It passes all these orders which allow, let's say, dams to be built and, you know, huge infrastructural projects to be built without rehabilitation of the people who are being displaced. But that same court, when those people arrive in the cities, pass orders saying things like slum dwellers are pickpockets of urban land. And, in Delhi, for the Commonwealth Games, huge numbers, hundreds of thousands of people are pushed out of the city. So they're pushed out of their villages. Then they're pushed out of the cities. Their, you know, industries are shut down because they are polluting or whatever it is that they're called. The city has to be clean now, you know, because the Commonwealth Games are coming or whatever. So, again, you're having this scene where there's a whole lot, a huge population of unwanted people who are just being pushed from here to there, from here to there, displaced by dams, resettled somewhere, displaced by something else, you know, again and again and again. And that is why now the Gandhian movements are being eclipsed and armed struggles are rising in places like Nandigram and Lalgarh and Singur and Jharkhand and Orissa. This is what's happening. People are just barricading themselves and saying, you can't come in. You know, because in order to push through this particular kind of development model, this particular kind of economic vision, now India has to become militarized. It has to become a police state. So you're having these warfare training schools being planned all over India. The first one has started in Chhattisgarh, where policemen are being trained to become the army. You know, they are being trained by army officers to become the army. Meanwhile, in Kashmir, which we haven't spoken about at all, which is the most highly militarized state in the world, which has between 500 and 700,000 soldiers there. I mean, at the height of the Iraq war, you had 180,000 soldiers in Iraq. You can imagine, there in Kashmir, there's one soldier for every 20 civilians or so. And in places like that, the army has turned into the police. You know, they are an administrative force. In the rest of India, the police is being turned into the army. But either way, the enemy is the people.
Two last questions. What of the wondrous state of Kerala in the south of India, where you come from, maybe the most successful communist government in all the world and all time, complete literacy, reasonable equality of opportunity and wealth and income? Where's Kerala in the new India?
Well, I must say that, you know, I grew up there, and when I first left Kerala and went up north, I was so shocked at what I saw, because Kerala is a whole different ball of wax, you know, and it does have very serious problems, but, you know, nothing compared to what's going on in Chhattisgarh and so on. what was fortunate for Kerala was that, unlike West Bengal, which had 30 years of non-stop Marxist government, which has now decimated that place, you know, any kind of power that just stays in place for so long is certainly going to rot. Whereas Kerala kept having elections, so often the communists are toppled, the Congress comes, and then, you know, so it goes. But now I think the communists are in deep trouble there. And we are looking at a situation where the parliamentary left in India is in very bad shape, and might just be decimated both in West Bengal and in Kerala. But, I mean, Kerala's literacy rate is a little bit of a myth. I don't think everybody is educated. I mean, I don't know how they describe literacy. I think if you can write your name or something like that. So maybe it's not 100%. And Kerala is also facing a pretty serious environmental problem. You know, it's a very beautifully diverse place in terms of environment, but the population density is so high that the water systems are all being blocked by a lot of building and development activity, which is causing trouble. And of course, a lot of the economy of Kerala was bolstered by many Malayalis who worked in the Gulf, and that collapse of Dubai and so on is causing serious problems.
Will Kerala count in the battle for the soul of India in the long run?
I don't think much. Kerala sort of somehow has always been outside on its own trajectory. It's a small place, you know, quite culturally different from the rest of India. So I don't think it's a major player in the battle for the soul of India. But
Arundhati Roy, it is a huge pleasure to tune in on you again. We read every word, and we're hugely grateful for this conversation.
Please don't be. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.